Okay, so that is from 2020, the Safety Mask Dance by Media Bear. And they seem to be producing quite a lot, Media Bear, at the moment, along similar sorts of lines. I suppose trying to make the all these virus measures fun, if that's at all possible. And every single one of those performers is wearing a mask. I'm very I'm sure you'll be very pleased to hear in that music video. I'll put a link up to that if you want to have listened to it, download it or whatever, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So welcome back to the not BCFM politics show, or not the BCFM politics show, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, again. All conspiracy, no theory. Bilderberg 2020 supposedly didn't take place because of the pandemic. But there and the guru, Henry Kissinger's control of politics in the NATO countries, did it go away? No, of course it didn't. And today we can reveal the extent to which they can help influence who will win the German election in 13 months' time. 13 months before the election's taking place, we've got a winner already, thanks to the Bilderberg chess man. And he's going to become a German chancellor, we believe, in September or October next year, 2021. And it will be revealed any minute now. So, more on the Beirut explosion too, the bomb, an accident, or just a regime change, eh? NATO surveillance planes were flying over the area at the time, it's revealed. Did they trigger a bomb? Well, whatever happened, Macron's visit seems to have triggered regime change in Lebanon, because the entire government has resigned, plunging the country further into political chaos. Not that the previous elections have been any way of clearing things up, and it seems as if there's going to be a real attempt to block Hezbollah from the new government. We shall see whether they get on. See what Martin's got to say about that. And also, Kamala Harris, the California state prosecutor, she's now Joe Biden's running mate in November's presidential election in the United States. Like Keir Starmer, Starmer was the equivalent of her here. He was the director of public prosecutions. Keir Starmer quashed two attempts by Surrey police to charge Jimmy Savile with child sex abuse offences whilst he was still alive. And he also backed the prosecution of Julian Assange. So what did Kamala Harris get up to in the US in her prosecutor job in California? Also, from the last US presidential election, more on Russiagate from a former Secret Service agent, Dan Bugino, who attempts to explain the backstory to the whole affair. And I think he's done better than I think than anyone else I've seen about explaining what was really going on in the United States over Russiagate, which the Western press absolutely refused to look at his version of events. Could the whole thing be a US-based attempt at election fixing? Well, he certainly puts that case pretty strongly. But Martin, I think we should probably go start this week by going back to one of the main stories over the last couple of weeks, and that is the Beirut explosion, we have to call it, I suppose, don't we, from last week. What, have you learnt any more about that? Because that had only just happened a couple of days before last week's programme.
Well, I saw what you saw earlier, which is that they've now admitted that there were NATO planes flying over Lebanon at the time, and various eyewitnesses said that they thought that the planes were in the air before the second explosion. Now, that doesn't necessarily prove anything, but I'm just saying that that's what a lot of people have been saying. Various theories have been advanced about whether it's an accident or not, but nevertheless, even if it is an accident, it's been leaped upon by the Western powers in order to demand changes in Lebanon, which they wanted to see anyway. So there were sanctions on Lebanon because of Hezbollah's presence in the government in Lebanon. And, you know, it's all very well for the West to say, oh, isn't it terrible? You know, you've had this big explosion and your economy is going to be in trouble, but we've got sanctions on you anyway because we don't like what your policies are.
Well, I mean,
are.
We know that the excellent journalist Robert Fisk lives in Beirut, in Lebanon, and he's in The Independent from time to time, blocked from the BBC for God knows why, because he's one of the greatest journalists on the planet, and he's got a tremendous amount of experience. He knows what's going on down there. The BBC don't want us to have the benefit of his knowledge. But he's done an article about the Beirut blast, which I wasn't very impressed with. It was just really looking at the sort of political situation, which most people kind of know anyway. But I tell you who has done a very good article, and that is a guy called Pepe Escobar in the Asia Times. He's written an article, say, who profits from the Beirut blast? with a pretty horrific picture, looking at this kind of turquoise lake that this explosion has left, that used to be the docks. The narrative, he says, Martin, the Beirut explosion was an exclusive consequence of negligence and corruption by the current Lebanese government, is now set in stone. At least in the Atlanticist sphere, he's talking here really about the Anglo-Zionist Empire, isn't he? And the media in that part of the world are saying this.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, Pepe Escobar is usually pretty good, but I mean, we can't say that we know what happened for sure.
He's saying, okay, let's just get into his line, which is, digging deeper, he says, we find that negligence and corruption may have been fully exploited via sabotage to engineer it.
Yes. And don't forget, it's very suspicious. It's a bit like the Chinese suddenly saying, hang on, we've had a swine virus which killed all our pigs, a bird virus that killed all our chickens, and then we got this human virus. We think we're under attack. Lebanon has been under attack by the Israelis and by the Western powers. And Macron has basically turned up because France used to be the colonial power in Lebanon. And they're basically saying, you know, we will help you, but we need you to do X, Y, and Z. You know, in other words, get Hezbollah out of the government and so on. And of course the Israelis had killed a Hezbollah official in Syria the previous week, and you know, there's ongoing conflict with Lebanon regarded as being part of the Syria-Iran axis, and you know, they want to break down the current
regime. I mean, Pepe Escobar's done a terrific job here because he's shown just how many people predicted something like this being used as an attempt of regime change.
Yes,
for example, back Asa Wynne-Stanley, back on in the Middle East Monitor, back in February 2016, says why an Israeli newspaper wanted to flatten a city of millions. That city was Beirut. Haaretz, apparently, in Israel's influential liberal daily, published a blood-curdling article openly arguing for war crimes on a massive scale against the civilian population of a neighbouring Arab state. Should Israel flatten Beirut to destroy Hezbollah's missiles? The article headline mused, written by Amitai Etzoni, a professor of international relations at George Washington University. He was also a member of the Palmach, a unit in one pre-state Zionist terrorist group, a forerunner of the Israeli military, participated in the Nabka, or catastrophe, Israel's 1948 ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians. This guy is now saying we should just flatten Beirut.
Yeah, well, there was another...
Beirut is just...
Another Israeli politician who was a former member of the Knesset was saying, this is, even if it is an accident, this is God's work, and we should be pleased because, this will put pressure on the Lebanese government to deal with Hezbollah, etc., etc. And, of course, they were also saying that Hezbollah controlled the port. Now, I've read different reports on this. Hezbollah denied that they control the port. It's actually in a Christian area, and most of the corruption in Lebanon is by the Christian community, who get this, they get 50% of the seats in parliament, even though in actual fact they're less than 50% of the population, and the other 50%, who are Muslim and Druze and Alawite, they get to make up they get to elect 50% of the parliament, even though they represent far more than that in terms of the population. And of course you've got millions of Palestinian refugees still living in Lebanon, and they don't get any vote at all. So the political system in Lebanon is rigged, but even within the rigged system, Hezbollah managed to establish that it was a legitimate partner to be included in government, and they're in alliance with one faction of the Christians, Michel Aoun, the president. It's always been a very unstable state, because Israel doesn't want it to be a stable state. Israel wants to steal the gas. There's a huge gas deposit, and the Israelis want that. There's a gas deposit offsite off Gaza as well, and they want that. And they've been pushing for, I mean, don't forget, there have been various unexplained explosions in Iran in the last few weeks, which of course are part of the whole game of putting pressure on Iran
to start a war. I mean, we haven't had any proper investigation into this blast, but we've still got headlines saying the following around the West. The Irish Times saying the corruption which led to this blast must be punished, and those responsible removed from office.
Yes, so in other words, it's being used as a mechanism to remake Lebanese politics.
And they have been removed from office.
They've resigned. There's going to be an election. But the elections are in a sense rigged, as I just explained. 50% of the seats go to Christians, even though they're less than 50% of the population. 50% of the seats go to everybody else, and they have to divide them up between them. The president has to be a Christian. The prime minister has to be a Sunni.
Is that like Tony Blair or George Bush, then?
Well, it's a different setup. It's a setup that was agreed at the end of the Civil War.
Ian Paisley?
Well, yeah, but the specifics of the Lebanese situation are clear. It's a sectarian constitution which was imposed on the country by the West in order to entrench Christian power. And the people who run the central bank, who are the ones who are the really corrupt ones, they are Christians, and they're in alliance with the West.
So what we had was a massive campaign saying this is the government's fault, the government's fault, the government's to blame. Then we had President Macron visiting, and then all of a sudden the government resigns. Now, I mean, it almost seems like a kind of scripted theatre play, this. France's Macron pushes for a government of technocrats to rescue Lebanon. This is Reuters today. French President Emmanuel Macron saying Lebanon's political leaders must install an interim technocrat government to enact reforms and back public confidence and persuade donors to release billions of dollars in aid. Apparently, Martin, donors are a little bit nervous about releasing any aid because they think that the country's unstable and the government they don't like. So they will get the aid, but only if they have Macron's technocrat government.
Yeah, well, that's what Macron would like. Interestingly enough, the Americans have not participated in Macron's little manoeuvre. They want sanctions on Lebanon to continue, as do the Israelis, and they're not interested.
This is a good cop, bad cop approach, isn't it?
Yeah, that's just about
a French diplomatic source said Macron delivered his message to Lebanon's political parties on the visit to Beirut 2 days after, that's on the 6th of August last week, that destroyed whole neighbourhoods, killed 172, or they now know over 200, and it's made a quarter of a million people homeless. The Lebanese government has since resigned amidst angry street protests. It continues in caretaker mode until a new administration is formed. Well, anyway, President Macron knows who he wants to run the country, and of course the French have a very important colonial historical role there, don't they?
They do.
It's almost like they're back again.
Well, that's right.
We never went away, actually.
Yeah, that's right. It's neo-colonialism.
So when he says a technocrat government, that means basically he wants to appoint them, does it?
Well, it means that they won't be related to the sectarian constitution of Lebanon. And there is a case that there should be a free election in Lebanon where the parties stand and whoever wins, wins. But then the Christian minority, and they are the minority, will feel that they're losing power. And that's what the Civil War was all about in the first place, because the French created Lebanon to keep the Christians in power.
Is Macron trying to get back to the same situation that led to the Civil War in Lebanon in the 80s?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, the French have traditionally seen their role as protecting the interests of the Christian minority in Lebanon. And that's why they set the country up in the first place, because it was originally part of Syria, and it would have just been a part of Greater Syria. But the Christian...
So what kind of Christians are we talking about here? Fascist Christians?
No, they're Maronite Christians. And Michel Aoun, for example, General Aoun, is in alliance with Hezbollah. Some Christians see Hezbollah as a guarantee of the independence of Lebanon from Israel. Other... Gamal, for example, and other Christians are fascists. They're phalangists. They're the people who carried out the Sabra and Shatila massacre in the refugee camps with the help of the Israelis. So one of the positive things about the end of the civil war in Lebanon was that there was a cross community alliance between some Christians and Hezbollah to prevent Saudi Arabia and Israel running the country. And Rafik Hariri, who was assassinated, of course, probably by the Israelis, not by Hezbollah, we could go into that, but his son was the prime minister, and he was kidnapped when he went to... He's actually a Saudi citizen and was born in Saudi, and he was kidnapped when he went to Saudi Arabia and told, you've got to change the government and all this other stuff. So there's lots of outside forces with their fingers in the pie there, and the real fundamental problem is that the Israelis want Hezbollah to be smashed and destroyed. That's their goal. They tried to do it in 2006. They failed. Hezbollah today is probably militarily stronger than ever, even though they've taken thousands of casualties fighting inside Syria. But the fighting itself was also...
So are Hezbollah unbeatable? Are they banging their heads against a brick wall?
Well, they seem to be. They seem to be. Hezbollah have basically checkmated the Israeli Defense Forces, and they know it.
But it may be Hezbollah about to be kicked out of the political system completely.
Well, that's
maybe defunded, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, they can't be necessarily defunded because they've got their own mechanisms for making money. You know, they've run a whole welfare system. There's no welfare state in Lebanon, you know. It is your political party that looks after you.
I mean, if the government turns against Hezbollah, surely they will be able to starve them of the resources they need to carry on.
Well, no, what will happen if Hezbollah are forced out of the government and the majority don't accept that is there'll be a return to civil war, is part of, from the Israeli point of view, that's fine.
We keep
them fighting.
Hearing, don't we, of course, about Hezbollah being a terrorist organisation, which of course they are.
Well, that's what's claimed by the German and the British governments. Up to now, both German and British governments accepted that Hezbollah had a military wing and a political wing. And the political wing was accepted, or in the sense of accepted, you know, we accept that that you've got a political point of view. That's changed very recently when we had a Tory government here who declared the political wing of Hezbollah as terrorists, and so have the Germans. But of course the Saudis aren't terrorists, even though all 19 hijackers on 9/11, were there any hijackers at all, they were all Saudis. Hezbollah is called terrorists by its enemies. They're no more terrorists than Palmach, as you mentioned earlier, or the Irgun, or the founders of the Israeli state. They're no different from that. In actual fact, Hezbollah is modelled on those Israeli terrorist organisations.
Let's move on to look at Belarus, which you were talking about on RT this week, Martin. The Belarus opposition candidate has fled to Lithuania amongst a crackdown on election protests. Tikhanovskaya, I think is her name.
Tikhanovskaya
has fled after publicly rejecting preliminary rejection results. So she's saying, it sounds to me a little bit like throwing the toys out of the playpen here, because surely if she wants to contest these elections, she's got to stay in the country. Why has she left?
Well, she says it's to look at her because of her kids, because she's a mother, you know, and she's got young kids, and therefore she's trying to protect them from any consequences. It's a very tricky situation. Lukashenko, in recent years, he came to power in the 1980s, when Belarus, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, 1990s, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and basically Belarus became what was regarded in the West as a backwater. So he was his original job was he was a manager of a collective farm. So, and Belarus is a largely rural country. A lot of people live in rural areas. So it's not as urbanized as other European countries. And what Lukashenko did is he said, whatever else happens, we are going to carry on with pretty much the same system we've had here since the war.
I mean, because, you know, you need to know where Belarus is. It's east of Poland. It's west of the Russian Federation. It's north of Ukraine. And it's sort of sandwiched in the middle of that lot. And it's so, in a way, it's kind of surrounded by Western-leaning countries, isn't it?
With apart from the Russian side.
Latvia and Lithuania. Yeah, apart from the Russian side. Latvia and Lithuania. To the north, and so what we're looking at here really is almost like a last outpost of the old Eastern European countries, one of the last ones left, and it's in a way, isn't it? I think it's Kaliningrad. It's kind of almost pointing towards Kaliningrad.
Poland? No, Kaliningrad is part of Russia. It was originally part of East Prussia.
But it's a little kind of part of it in the Baltic, as I understand it.
Well, Kaliningrad was given to Russia at the end of the war, and it originally had a German population, and were all expelled to Germany, and it's now got a largely Russian-speaking population. And they are part of the Russian Federation.
What you've got is the
Suwalki Gap between Kaliningrad and Belarus is of strategic importance.
It is, isn't it?
To the west and to the Russians.
So
that Suwalki Gap is a real
the poor old Kaliningradians, whatever you call them, are just about isolated. The closest Russian leaning country to them is Belarus.
That's right.
And I think it looks to me like something like 50, 60, 70, 100 mile maybe.
Yeah.
Distance between them, with Poland and Lithuania kind of sandwiching the gap together. So this is level with the bottom of the Baltic Sea is Belarus. But Martin, you know, is it going to be like a? It does remind me actually. I think it was it Tymoshenko did a similar thing, didn't she? She fled the country in Ukraine when she was a pro-Western presidential candidate that didn't get elected.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can see there's continuity between what's happening in Belarus and what happened in Ukraine. And one of the things that was very interesting that happened last week, because I'll just briefly run through the history of it, otherwise people won't understand what's gone on. He came to power in the 90s, and what he basically promised the rather elderly and rural population of Belarus is, we're not going to have any experiments here. We're going to keep the collective farms, we're going to keep you in work, we're not going to change anything very much. And so when Yeltsin was in power in Russia, and the massive privatizations went on, and the best predal years of the mafia taking over and all the rest of it, Belarus was a backwater in the sense that it didn't get involved in any of that. And I've spoken to a Russian woman who works over here some while ago now. She works in schools like I do. That's just how I met her on a course. And she's saying her father lives in Belarus, and she's from Belarus, and he used to be in the military, and his view is that we just want stability. And, of course, they're Russian speakers, by and large. It's a slightly different accent. Apparently, you can tell the difference if you know. But they're basically Russian speakers, and they watch what happened in Ukraine with some horror, because obviously that's turned into a big mess, and Belarus has largely avoided that kind of conflict. And that's why Lukashenko has had in the West they don't like him, they see him as a dictator, but of course to the people who vote for him, and there's quite a substantial proportion of the population probably still did vote for him last week, is because he's basically offered them stability without any big changes. We're not going to be at the forefront of anything
Don't the Belarusians want big, fast American cars and that sort of thing?
Well, no, they don't. They quite rightly drew the conclusion that in actual fact they'd rather carry on pretty much as they were, and he appealed to that sentiment. And if you look in Poland and Hungary, you will see that right-wing forces, which the West doesn't particularly like, are quite powerful because these are more rural countries. People like conservatism. Now, in Belarus, conservatism means pro-Russian stroke Sovietism. That's what the older population feel comfortable with. Younger population, obviously, much less so. Now, what Lukashenko has been doing in the last few years, he's been starting, instead of sticking to, we're going to just be quiet here, we're not going to do anything dramatic, we're just going to keep things as they are. And what he started to do is to talk to the West about, maybe we could do some privatization. Maybe we could, you know, why can't we do this and that and the other? And, of course, the Russians aren't very happy about that, because Belarus has only been allowed to be a backwater because the Russians subsidize their energy supplies, for example. Yeah, they don't pay market prices for things like gas and oil, which has allowed Lukashenko to remain in power.
So do you think there's been, to a certain extent, a deliberate looking over the southern border to Ukraine by political forces in Belarus, saying, well, look, you know, do you really want to go down that road?
That's right. That's if you were trying to describe why is Lukashenko a relatively popular politician, if he is, it's because he's kept...
he's just won the election.
Well, yes, indeed. I don't think he won it with 80% of the vote, which is one of the issues we'll come to in a minute. But what happened there is he also... One of the things that happened last week was that a group of Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group went to Minsk. They were on their way to...
This is the capital, right?
Yeah,
in the middle,
yeah. They were on their way to fly to Syria to do stuff in Syria. And then they were told that their flight had been cancelled. And then the Ukrainian SBU, the secret services in Ukraine, phoned up Lukashenko and said, there are a number of Russian military personnel in Minsk who are there to stir up protests against you after the election. Because in recent years, Lukashenko has been biting the hand that feeds him in Russia. And in actual fact, I've been looking at quite a lot of RT coverage of what's been happening in Belarusia, and they are not at all necessarily in favour of Lukashenko, because Lukashenko had started to be he was not being cooperative from Putin's point of view.
Yeah, starting to go native,
he was starting to play both sides against the middle. Yeah, so he wants to carry on having subsidized gas and oil.
Very dangerous game if you've got NATO on one side and the Russian Federation
indeed.
On the other.
So anyway, what he did is he arrested all of these Russian mercenaries. Then the Russians then pointed out to him what had happened, which is that these guys weren't even supposed to be in Minsk. They were just on a stopover going to Syria, and they certainly weren't there to stir anything up. They were just going off to do jobs in Syria, you know, like mercenaries.
So they said their plane was cancelled and they weren't there to do anything naughty. Did he believe them?
Well, I think what's going to happen with that is now the pressure's on, he suddenly realised that he can't, in fact, afford to alienate the Russians in the way that he has. And basically, he was played for a fool by the Ukrainian SBU. And that doesn't suggest that he's that bright. He's not university educated. He was he basically used to run a collective farm. And he's not a genius by any stretch of the imagination. Anyway, so now what's happened is they had the election. Now, Tikhanovskaya, they said she got 10% of the vote and Lukashenko got 80%. I think that's, you know, and Lukashenko did do things like, it was made pretty clear if you worked for the government that you would be expected to be voting for him if you wanted to keep your job, all that sort of thing. So he's got, you know,
so they don't have a secret ballot then?
Well, they do, but they can make it known.
Like here, yes. For example, like the little numbers on your branch.
You know, if you are the established government, it does give you, I mean, what's going to happen in this country, for example, is Boris Johnson is going to change all the constituency boundaries before the next election. Those are the sorts of things you can do. Yeah, they do it in the United States. If you look at some of the constituency boundaries in the United States, they're absolutely ridiculous, you know.
Okay, well, let's just go back to the actual election figures and how accurate they might or might not be.
Well, I would suggest that Tikhanovskaya probably got something like between 20 and 30% of the vote. But Lukashenko, being a control freak, decided that he was going to say she got 10% of the vote. And I think that was a mistake by him, because it made it look as if he was cheating, which he probably was. But I think you've also got to draw the conclusion. Some people say, I mean, Tikhanovskaya herself said, oh, it's absolutely opposite to that. I got 80% of the vote and he got 10%. Now, I think you've got to actually answer the question, how did Lukashenko stay in power all these years? Been re-elected several times. Now, of course, it's a fairly authoritarian state. They don't really allow opposition voices in the state-controlled media. You know, they've got all sorts of mechanisms for keeping people in line. But
secret police, for example.
Yeah, secret police who can follow people around and, you know, make it difficult for people who want to stand against the government, all the rest of it. But nevertheless, you've got to recognise that he's got some basis of support, otherwise he wouldn't be there. And the basis of support he has is the rural elderly population, who do not want change. They do not, for example, want the collective farms broken up and all the land sold off to Western investors, because that means they're all going to die of starvation.
I mean, in Eastern Europe, Belarus, it really is one of the last men left standing.
Yes, I mean, Belarus is not a very big country.
As an independent nation, I mean, it doesn't sound it's totally dependent on Russia. They've got some form of independence, even though they're aligned with Moscow.
They've actually got they're part of a bi-national setup with Russia. So they're not part of the Russian Federation, but it's considered that they are a fraternal country. So, for example, there's no barriers to people from Belarus going to Russia or Russians going to Belarus, yeah? Well, it's just not the case in elsewhere. And, of course, they can look south to Ukraine and see, because the Ukrainian economy is completely crashed now, and, of course, loads of people were killed in the fighting in the Donbass. And they can look at that and think, well, we don't really want that. They can look north to the Baltic states and realise that the super free market policies pursued in the Baltic states and going into the Eurozone has basically wrecked the economy in Latvia. And basically all of the young people have had to leave the country and come and work in the West because there's no work in the Baltic states. And you can see why Lukashenko's foot dragging, which is what it is, you know, he started talking to the IMF and so on about getting money, but they're saying, well, you'll have to privatise. Oh, I don't know if we want to privatise. What he's been doing is trying to look after his own interests as a political leader. But he's also got some support because his line of let's not do anything hasty here, let's not wreck everything that we built up over 40 years of the Soviet Union. And the people in Belarus were quite happy in the 90s when Russia was going down the drain. They were not. I mean, they basically kept a lot of the previous Soviet setup, including, you know, social benefits and pensions and so forth. But, of course, it's a bit of delusion because the Russians subsidised that. They haven't got the basis of it for it independently.
Okay, well, let's move on to look at a pretty comprehensive look at Belarus there, as we do try and do whenever there's a big election and controversy. Just finally on that one, Martin, you know, looking at the scenes in the street, it looked to me as if somebody somewhere didn't like the result of the election. And it's almost like, well, there's always immense criticism in the Western press of an election when the wrong person gets elected. It almost doesn't seem to matter how much integrity the elections have. It's just, you know, you have to vote for the right person. If you don't, then, you know, this has been some sort of forgery.
Well, loads of young people are, you know, you can imagine, they've got the same access to the internet that other people have got. They want a different life. You know, they feel that this old guy's been in charge forever. Who the hell is he? You know, they've been there 26 years. So if you're younger than 26, he's been there as long as you've been alive. And there's inevitably going to be young people saying, well, we want change here. And of course, they've been encouraged by the West. Yeah. The West has basically said, go out into the streets and we'll back you.
Now, so of course, do you think it eventually
shoots them all down? They won't be.
Will it eventually go the way of Ukraine, do you think?
No, I think what will happen is this wave of, this is just prediction, this wave of protests will continue for a while, but they've got a fundamental problem, which is they didn't win the election. Lukashenko cheated, but the opposition didn't win the election. They haven't got enough support. And there's a way you could negotiate this. I mean, the Baltic states like Lithuania have offered themselves as mediators. The Hungarians have offered themselves as mediators as well. And it's possible that Lukashenko could probably discuss with Tikhanovskaya about the possibility of, you know, we might be willing to talk to you about what we could do in the future. That would be a positive outcome, but I think more likely is that it will just die out, because eventually it will. If you either win the election or you don't, you can protest as much as you like. Doesn't change the result if another election isn't called. And what will probably happen is Lukashenko will go rushing back to Putin and say, can you help me? Can you help me? And Putin will say, well, you've not been very cooperative from our point of view for quite a long time, actually. So, I mean, I think
He won't say no, I won't help you, though, will he?
No, he won't. But he's going to extract a price for it.
Yeah. Okay, so we will get to the new, the next German Chancellor, revealed exclusively on this programme 13 months before the election, in a moment. But before that, Kamala Harris, Martin, let's start by having a listen. This is the Vice President pick of Joe Biden for the Democrats to run against Donald Trump in November in the US presidential elections, a state prosecutor. And let's have a listen now to the Tucker Carlson show, where Peter Schweitzer, the author who's written a book on corruption, including quite a lot about Kamala Harris, appeared.
Senator Harris, Kamala, spent 7 years as San Francisco's top prosecutor before spending 6 years as the attorney general of the state of California. How'd she do? Peter Schweitzer is author of the book Profiles in Corruption. Peter, great to see you. How did she do?
Not well at all, particularly on very sensitive, explosive cases, including child sexual abuse. Tucker, from 2004 to 2011, she was San Francisco Attorney General. She did not prosecute a single case of sexual abuse involving Catholic Church priests. To put that in context, of the 50 largest cities in America, all 50 of them prosecuted at least one case during that time period, except for Kamala Harris. And in addition to that, she inherited from her predecessor, Terrence Hallinan, hundreds of pages of internal Catholic documents that included the names of 40 current or recent priests who had been charged by parishioners with molestation. Hallinan was using those documents to build criminal cases, and he was also planning to release them after redacting the names of victims. Kamala Harris actually deep-sixed that document and froze those documents, and those documents disappeared, much to the chagrin of victims groups. So it's a massive cover-up, and a lot of the people that financed her campaign to beat Hallinan were law firms and lawyers and people connected to the church hierarchy who did not want that those documents to come out.
So do you think it's possible, and I wish we had more time, I hope you'll come back, but do you think it's possible, bottom line, that she did not prosecute child molestation because she got campaign donations?
Yes, and also some of the institutions we're talking about, like St. Ignatius Prep, an elite prep school in San Francisco, has very, very high ties. Jerry Brown was an alma mater. The Getty family, who are big backers of her, multiple generations have gone to that school. This report would have been deeply embarrassing to very powerful institutions.
Peter Schweitzer, thanks so much for that.
So that's Peter Schweitzer speaking on Fox News about that. Obviously, it's a network which is very much opposed to the Democratic Party, Martin. But this is a pretty worrying stuff done by an investigative journalist there about these state prosecutors. I guess all around the world, the state prosecutor is potentially the most corrupt person in that country. If they've been got at for whatever reason and they're not prosecuting people, this is a horrendous situation. I mean, as he's talking about there, about the disappearance of all these child abuse files under her watch, this is rather reminding me of the situation we had here back in 2014. I think it was 114 Home Office files relevant to allegations of a child abuse network disappeared from the government records here in the UK too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that much about her, apart from the fact that she's an establishment-oriented Democrat. She's no Tulsi Gabbard. And in fact, Tulsi Gabbard was in the debates with her. She ran for president, and she couldn't get a glove on Tulsi Gabbard.
Well, this is ridiculous, isn't it? Because Tulsi Gabbard would have been actually possibly far better bet to beat Donald Trump. What the hell do the Democrats think they're doing?
Protecting their corporate backers. That's why Biden's been chosen, because he's a safe pair of hands from their point of view. So that won't necessarily do them any harm, because if you imagine, if you'd had Bernie Sanders and Tulsi Gabbard as the Democratic ticket, that would have been amazing. But you'd have seen exactly the same kind of pressure on them as we saw on Jeremy Corbyn here. The corporate media would have gone absolutely berserk to stop them. So what's happened? Because the DNC committee have rigged all of this, and Biden has been told that Kamala's is going to be his, you know, because she's ostensibly a black woman. She's not that black, but you know that's the way they're spinning it, and it's the way they think. And because she's been a top lawyer, that sounds as if she's respectable. You know, she's not just some rabble rouser from the gutter.
This is where I drag things back, much to your chagrin, to Keir Starmer, because, as I said in the introduction,
he's a very similar character.
He is. I mean, what we've seen from him is him blocking these two prosecutions of Jimmy Savile when Jimmy Savile was still alive for child sexual abuse by Surrey Police. Starmer said, "Oh, there's nothing to see here," and blocked that prosecution by the Crown Prosecution Service. And we've seen the similar things with Julian Assange, actually endorsing those cases against Assange when actually Assange had not committed any crime whatsoever under British law.
Well, these are
key people, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But you will understand.
And it seems to me what's going on here is we've got, once somebody's in that position, they've been blackmailed, bribed, or whatever. That their name has been completely blackened by a complete miscarriage of justice, by stopping a state prosecution or making one that shouldn't have happened. That they then get seen as, oh well, this person is really corrupt. So they make a great run for a more senior position. In fact, as vice president.
Yeah, I think that's fairly accurate. I mean, what you've got, don't forget that the people who crunch the numbers of cephology, who gets elected and so on, the fact that these people have got, I mean, she's got a reputation for being, she prosecuted loads of people who shouldn't have been prosecuted, you know, and basically, miscarriages of justice. She insisted that the people stay in prison, and so she's got a law and order kind of agenda behind her, as that's how it appears, you know. And of course, and the Catholic Church like her because she didn't cause trouble for them. And of course, what Biden and
maybe
and,
the Vatican like her.
Yeah, well, I mean, right. The point is that the Democrats are trying to flag up that they are the safe pair of hands. We've got these establishment lawyers and various other people, and then you've got Trump, who's a loony.
But we're talking
for us
here about a sort of Illuminati, really, aren't we? Because an elite who are, you know, kind of mafia blackened, they have their mafia bribed or whatever, or blackmailed, and then once they're totally corrupt, then they're fit for office. I mean, that's completely the opposite of what the people want. And if you go and have a look in Spain, amazingly, this we've seen over the last few weeks, Spain's scandal hit hit former king has had to flee. A lot of people are saying, oh, we can't tell you where he is, but most people in the know, including the Bangkok Post, say it's pretty certain he's gone to the Dominican Republic. So even if somebody is in that position, as King Juan Carlos was, as the head of state, they're corrupt, they're found to be corrupt, they're prosecuted, and of course he couldn't be prosecuted when he was king, but now after he abdicated, he can be prosecuted. So he's now had to flee the country to somewhere as reliable as Dominican Republic, which of course is another very corrupt country. It's in it next to Haiti. I think it's joined on to Haiti.
Yeah.
So we think he's in the Dominican Republic. They won't officially say where he is, but you know, this is a pretty sorry state of affairs where you've got so much massive corruption right at the very, very top of this. Is in Spain and in other parts of the world.
Yeah, don't forget
the United States.
Yeah, but don't forget nobody gets to vote for the king. But the other thing about this is, if you look at the way under first past the post systems in Britain and the US, the actual number of people who vote that change the decision is actually quite small. They're in certain constituencies in certain states, and they are tending to be rather conservative minded, middle of the road voters. And therefore, if you want to be President of the United States or Prime Minister of Britain, you've got to win over those people. And those people don't give a stuff about Jimmy Savile. I'm afraid you do, I do, they don't. They quite like the idea that people on benefits...
No, I don't think that's entirely true. I think they do care about things like Savile, which was...
Well, maybe.
Well, just a minute. I'm saying the media haven't been talking about that at all. No, I have seen no media reports in the mass media at all about Keir Starmer's role in making sure that Jimmy Savile was not prosecuted while he was still alive.
Well, no.
Not one.
Well, that's what this show's about, Tony. But you'll understand that from the point of view of the establishment, and also the point of view of Labour MPs in Bristol...
I mean, I think, for example, I know what you're saying, but if we saw a panorama the night before an election all about how Keir Starmer was involved in that, I don't think Keir Starmer would do too well, do you?
Yeah, but do you think Panorama are going to do that the night before an election? Of course they're not. They wouldn't be allowed to under the electoral rules
actually,
anyway.
They might be able to if it was a balanced report and if they showed both sides and gave Keir Starmer every opportunity to appear, which he probably wouldn't want to.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact is, the problem for Keir Starmer is that even under a first-past-the-post election, the Scots are never going to vote for him. And therefore, the Labour Party used to rely upon a solid phalanx of Scottish MPs, which they can no longer do.
Okay, and before...
So that's gonna scupper any, you know, he's got such a lot to do. I mean, and he's still stuck on the idea that he's just got to win back.
He's great.
The people who voted Tory.
He's great for Boris. He's great for Boris anyway. Look, before we get off the subject of Assange, the CIA, this is in Consortium News, the CIA, this is the 22nd of July, I missed this one, is obsessed apparently with the former UK envoy who will testify in the spying on Assange case. Craig Murray says he's been asked to testify in the case of illegal spying against Julian Assange.
Yeah.
A former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, close associate of imprisoned WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange, says he was the top target of the 24/7 surveillance of Assange at Ecuador's embassy in London by the Spanish security company UC Global, which, according to press reports and court documents, shared the surveillance with the CIA, so they were probably employed by them. Craig Murray says he's been contacted by a lawyer at the spying case on Assange, said he will be going to Madrid to testify. The founder of UC Global, David Morales, was arrested over the surveillance, including privileged Assange lawyer conversations, and is on trial. Murray told former CIA analyst Ray McGovern in an email shared with Consortium News, with Murray's permission, the CIA was obsessed with him. So it almost seems as if the Americans are trying to control the outcome of these various court cases with this former British ambassador involved here in the UK, both his own court case and the Julian Assange case.
Well, of course. I mean, it's the US deep state that wants to extradite him. I can't see any basis in British law for him to be extradited. So, of course, Keir Starmer, very, very clear indication of which side he's on. But then you'll find that lots of Labour MPs think that Julian Assange is a bad guy and all the rest of it, which just goes to show how in the pocket they all are, doesn't it?
And before we leave the US theme, final one here is the Trump is saying he's got a lot of rich enemies. This might be the last time you see me. This was a very enigmatic press conference he gave. I think it was the end of last weekend, where he seems to be implying that he's really annoying a lot of people in the pharmaceutical industry. Let's have a listen to this now.
I've heard the term middlemen for a long time. They are so wealthy. They are so wealthy. Nobody has any idea who the hell they are, what they do. They make more money than the drug companies. You know, in all fairness, at least the drug companies have to produce a product. And it has to be a good product. But the middlemen, well, the rebate that I'm doing cuts out the middlemen and it reduces costs and the money goes back to the people purchasing the drugs. So I have a lot of enemies out there. This may be the last time you'll see me for a while. A lot of very, very rich enemies, but they are not happy with what I'm doing. But I figure we have one chance to do it, and no other president's going to do what I do. No other president would do a favored nations, a rebate, a buy from other nations at much less cost. Nobody.
So that's President Trump there speaking last weekend. I think it was, Martin, certainly within the last week and a half, talking about a rebate system he wants to bring in, which is going to make sure that Americans pay for drugs, because he's realised that there's quite a scam going on there. The cheapest price from other parts of the world. So if the American drug companies are overcharging for certain drugs in the United States, he will be making sure that there are imported drugs which will compete with them.
Yeah, well, he's trying to get elected, isn't he? I mean, he's saying this stuff. I mean, you've only said, you don't know how they make their money. I feel like saying, how did you make your money, Donald Trump? Because in actual fact, it looks like you were a made man for the mafia for years, and lots of your real estate companies went bankrupt and were bailed out.
You mean a middleman?
Yeah.
Well, that's what he's accusing them of being.
Well, exactly.
But I mean, this isn't a massive business, isn't it? So if you can be a sort of broker between public or service users of various sorts and a business of some sort, then you don't really actually do anything. You just make loads of money on someone else's need to do it. Now, this seems to me to be one of the massive growth industries in the world today. People who are making a fortune out of doing absolutely nothing.
Well, it's what I was calling in the first hour, the rentier economy. Yeah. It's a fundamental question in economics. You know, there's entrepreneurs who create new products and there are rentiers who basically don't. They're basically parasitic. And you've got to draw a distinction between productive and unproductive investment, which Michael Hudson is very keen on. And of course, lots of what people get paid for in this country is essentially parasitic. So in other words, when these City of London guys say, yes, I work so hard, I get up at 6 a.m, I don't go to bed till 1 o'clock, and I earn billions, you say, but what you're doing is actually harmful. We don't want you to do it. Lots of stuff that goes on. Buy-to-let landlordism is a small thing, but it's the same sort of thing. Lots of people make money without doing any useful work. They're not the people who drive buses.
I'm reminded of that Attila the Stockbroker song, bleep off bankers. I think he was wanting to say, oh, we just go, you know?
Yep.
Anyway, so let's have a listen now to our Bilderberg exclusive, which is with Manfred Petrich from Abkhazia and the All Smoke and Mirrors blog. All conspiracy, no theory. Bilderberg 2020 supposedly didn't take place because of the pandemic. And also, Guru Henry Kissinger's control of policies for the NATO countries. Did it go away? No, of course it didn't. Let's have a listen now to Manfred Petrich announcing who he believes, and I would definitely put your money on this guy because of the past experience we've had with these Bilderberg types suddenly finding themselves in power. He's predicting the results of the German elections in 13 months' time, amongst other things. And I speak to him here on an extended interview.
My name is Manfred Petrich. I run a political alternative blog, news blog, since nearly 20 years for the German-speaking population of Europe. And I've been working before in Switzerland for 30 years in the banking business. So I have some know-how about the financial situation also, not only the political.
Look, one of the things that we have a mutual interest in, Manfred, is following these Bilderberg conferences. Some of the work I've done over the years, along with others, has put together a bit of a jigsaw about how it all started. I mean, this was a conference which was begun as a kind of political version of NATO in 1954 in Oosterbeek in Holland, just near the city of Arnhem. And the first chairman was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a former SS officer before the war. He then married into the Dutch royal family and suddenly turned onto our side. But there are all sorts of suspicions about him and to what extent he really was on the Allies' side in the war. He was the first chairman there. And also there was a battle which took place, as many people have seen, the Bridge Too Far in Arnhem and around Arnhem, and at Oosterbeek, which was the same town which 10 years after the war is where the Bilderberg started, almost like a little in-joke that the Nazis had actually won that battle with the help of their spies in the Allied camp and also, of course, within the British establishment, people like Peter Carrington, who went on to become Secretary General of NATO, was what the guy in charge of the British defence when the Northern Ireland troubles started and the parachute regiment shot into the crowds in Northern Ireland back in the 1970s. Anyway, these conferences, apparently it's not taking place this year. They've been taking place annually. They even have the cheek, these super rich and super powerful people, the bankers, the monarchs, and the press barons, as well as high-tech technology, genetic scientists, etc., from all over the Western world, mainly the NATO countries, of course. They all get together every year. This year, they haven't got together. They say that anyway, Manfred. Do you believe them?
Well, that's, first of all, Prince Bernhard was not only a member of the SS, he was also a member of the SR, and he was also an early, very early member of the NSDAP, of the National Socialist Party, the Nazi Party. So he was a member of all the organizations. Now, that they...
Hang on. Before we leave Bernhard, wasn't he also part of IG Farben as well? I think, I understand he was.
He was a representative.
A very, very interesting organization. It was during the war. It was a great big industrial and chemical cartel. Can you tell us a bit about them?
Well, IG Farben was a huge chemical conglomerate which was operating worldwide, creating all sorts of chemical products. And one of these products was the one used in Auschwitz, you know.
The Zyklon B. It's a very important cartel because this was a model which the Nazis were quite fond of. They were also using cartels in all sorts of other industries, including things like the steel industry, where basically all the big companies, I mean, we could probably look at the media and banking today and, you know, electricity generation in a similar light, where you've got maybe anything between about 5 or 20 companies all really working together. So when there's some business, they will all bid for that business. And then once one of them wins it, they've already decided who's going to win it. They then split and divide up the work between the various companies. So there's no real competition. This is a cartel system. This is a oligopoly monopoly that they were quite fond of. And I think that a lot of the Bilderbergs like to work like this, you know, so you've got, you know, several press people and they're saying, well, actually, let's all take the same line. And you end up on a newsstand with, say, 5 or 6 different newspapers that all take the similar attitude on something.
Yes. For instance, and we talked about this before regarding the history of the EU, that the Nazis were actually the founders of the EU because they started very early to think about what will happen if we lose the war, how we will continue this philosophy of a unified Europe and one currency and one population and one nationality, which was actually the Nazi philosophy. What they did is they created all the fundament, the base for what we have now as the EU.
Well, they had plenty of warning of that, didn't they? Because once the Battle of Stalingrad had happened, in 1942, I think it was winter 42-43, everybody pretty much with any intelligence in Nazi Germany knew that the end was nigh. And so they had really, 2 years at least, more than that, in fact, to prepare for the end of the war and to make sure that any ill-gotten gains were squirreled away for a kind of resurgence after the war, if necessary.
Well, what was the first cartel that they created? It was the Montanunion. The Montanunion was their first base and step going into the common market and later into European Union. It was the union of all the steel producers in Germany, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, etc. That was the Montanunion. And that was the first step that they created this monopoly, right? Well, anyway, Prince Bernhard was in charge of IG Farben regarding France, right? And I also found a letter he wrote to Hitler where he wanted to become the governor of the Netherlands for Hitler, right?
Oh, right. Was that after the occupation or before?
No, it was before.
Ah, right? Okay.
And so forth. And there is also a photo around where the royal yacht of the Netherlands royal family was flying the Nazi flag. I've got this photo. So the royal family of the Netherlands were completely on the side of the Reich.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, Manfred, because I think Royal Dutch Shell, for example, they did made quite a lot of effort to basically not choose sides, and they had in fact divided up quite a lot of their business. So part of it was working with the Nazis, and the other part of it was working with the Allies. So there is this strategy that also bankers like the Wallenberg brothers in Sweden did, where they would have, say, one brother who was banking for the Nazis, and the other brother was banking for the Allies.
Yeah, but Shell was already at that time a huge global company. So they were working in, for instance, in Malaysia and in the Dutch West Indies, you know, which the Japanese then conquered, Indonesia, Malaysia, and so forth. And they were working also in America. So Shell was all over the place, and that's why they were working with both sides.
Well, let's get back to the original question about Bilderberg Conference 2020.
Yes.
The Bilderbergs say we never met this year because of the virus.
Well, it would be a big bad example, if they, and probably they're scared themselves. So what they probably did is a teleconference.
But I don't necessarily agree with that either, because I think one of the reasons that they do meet in person is so that they can do deals which can't be put under surveillance, that they can do a face-to-face deal with somebody and say, right, well, if anything happens to this.
But if they would have met, if you cannot hide that, that would have come out somehow, right? You cannot hide that 130 people meet in a hotel. That you can hide the before the meeting all the things, but not afterwards, because then people would find out what the hell is going on. Why is the hotel closed? Why are the roads closed? Why is this area wherever it happens closed? Why is there so much police there? There would be a lot of questions asked, and journalists would write about that.
Well, maybe they would. And maybe they've just been really, really clever, because even the journalists have found it difficult to travel around. I think it's just about possible. We have to agree to disagree. But do you think that maybe something else has happened rather than the full Bilderberg meeting in 2020?
Well, what happens is always the meeting of the steering committee, which happens in October, because the meeting of the steering committee is the one that prepares the meeting then in May, June following. And they, these 30 people meet, and I was able to watch this once in Rome where they met. And I was also in the hotel where they met, because they couldn't reserve the whole hotel for themselves with 30 people, like they do normally when the big meeting happens, where they block the whole place. So there are two meetings, the meeting of the steering committee around October and the general meeting in May or June. Now, I think that this was not a person-in-person meeting, which would mean it was the first time in 55 years or whatever that they did not have a meeting in a year, right?
Well, apart from 1975, when Prince Bernhard was involved in the Lockheed scandal, so much seems to come back to him. Right, they had to cancel the meeting that year because he had done a $1 million deal with Lockheed. Person, you know, basically, he had taken a bribe of $1 million from Lockheed in order to get them to buy the Dutch Air Force to buy Lockheed Starfighter jets, and he'd been discovered doing that. He was discredited, so they had to cancel the meeting in 75. But you might be right. Maybe this is the first one since then.
This reminds me, by the way, of the king of the former king of Spain having to escape to, where did he go to? Saudi Arabia somewhere, because also this corruption and bribe thing. I mean, that's a big thing for Spain, that the king, the former king, had to leave the country because of corruption.
Juan Carlos, you're talking about Juan Carlos there. He was one of the attendees of Bilderberg, of course.
Well, yeah, sure, yeah. In Spain, yeah, when it was in Sitges in Spain, yeah. Absolutely. But what we want to talk about is the latest news regarding Bilderberg, and that is that one of the attendees is now has been designated as chancellor candidate for Germany. And I've been, and you, also you and other Bilderberg who cover Bilderberg meetings know that there is a pattern in these meetings, and that is that many politicians who come to the meetings make very steep careers upwards and become heads of state.
And, well, that's absolutely right. I mean, the most obvious ones, certainly when I first started covering all of this back in the 1990s, were these two characters, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. It turns out that just either 1 or 2 years before they got the top job. For example, with Blair, when he's made, the leader of the Labour Party, which was in opposition at the time, and Bill Clinton, when getting the Democratic nomination over in the United States, that literally very quickly, just before that, they had been to one of these Bilderberg meetings. So, you know, this is one of the toxic sides of all of this, because once you've got international mass media behind you, the Western press behind you, obviously, people are more likely within your own political party or whatever to vote for you. You know, they can see you're getting good coverage in the press and they think, well, this guy's a winner. And that seems to be the way that Bilderberg does this. But anyway, what's this latest bit of news from Germany then?
Well, in 2010, I was in Sitges in Spain and I was covering the Bilderberg meeting there. And we were able to, for the first time, photograph every attendee and his face, and we put these photos on the internet. So what we did...
Hang on, Manfred, because that was really difficult. Like the Chantilly venue, you are kept a very long distance at Sitges, away from the actual hotel itself. And not only that, it's surrounded by trees, you know. How on earth are you getting photographs of everybody there? Because, they come in these darkened cars with tinted windows. It's very difficult to get a photograph through the window of a car as it's driving in or out. And so you have no access at all at Sitges.
That's true. The entrance gate was at least 2 kilometers away from the hotel itself. So we were kept very far away, and the police, you know, they had surrounded the whole place, and there was no way we could go in and catch somebody. So we were very frustrated that we were there covering, but couldn't take one single photo of a person. So what we did on Saturday evening, we decided that one of the professional photographers who was there should get dressed up in a camouflage dressing and then sneak up a hill which overlooks the hotel. And he managed to do that, and he came down, he robbed down more or less on his stomach, getting closer and closer. And he had a huge tele lens camera. And on Sunday, when the Bilderbergers were leaving the meeting to go home, they were all standing outside of the hotel entrance waiting for their bus or their limousines to pick them up, to take them to the airport. And in this way, we were able to photograph every person who was there. And that was kind of a miracle, in a way. And that was a sensation, because it was the first time we could prove all, with photos of who was there at the Bilderberg meeting.
Yeah, because you've got a problem, haven't you? You've got a problem in that you get an official list, which is usually given out after the last guests leave, or it used to be in those days anyway. And certainly I spoke to the woman up at Turnberry in 1998, I think it was, at the Bilderberg conference there, who served Tony Blair his breakfast. The only thing was, he wasn't on the official list. So there are people at these meetings who will not be on those official lists.
Exactly. And they are the most interesting. You see, the people that are missing on the list, but you catch them with a photo, that is a sensation, because then you can prove, look, they were there, right?
You can also prove, look, Bilderberg is lying. It's list.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Or they are leaving out members on the list, right? Anyway, as I said before, my blog is for the German-speaking countries. I, of course, saw one German politician there, and that was Olaf Scholz. And I outed him with his face on my blog that he was an attendee. And what happened then, this got around, and he was asked as a member of the SPD, which is the Social Democrats of Germany, if he was there. And he denied it. But I showed the photo and said, look, you were there. That's your photo. That's your face, right? And I wrote some articles about that we should now watch from now on his political career and see where it goes. And as I said before, the latest news is that Olaf Scholz, who was an attendee at the 2010 Bilderberg meeting, has been now nominated as the chancellor candidate for the Social Democrats for next year's election in Germany.
Can you just explain for us, you know, how the political process works in Germany? Because it's a bit different to most countries in that you have coalitions, don't you?
Yes. Well, so I discovered that Olaf Scholz was there at the Bilderberg meeting, and I watched his career, which started in 2001 by becoming a senator of Hamburg. And then between 2002 and 2004, he was general secretary of the Social Democrats. And then later on, 2007 to 2009, he was minister for work and social. And then he became, from 2011 to 2018, the mayor of Hamburg. And Hamburg is not just a city, it's also a state. So it's a very important position in the German political landscape if you are the mayor of Hamburg. And so this shows how he made a career upwards. And then he became, in 2018, he became for a short time the head of the Social Democrats. And now, in August 2020, he has been nominated as the chancellor candidate for the federal elections in 2021, in next year. And he has a big chance of winning this election because Merkel is absolutely unpopular, and she anyway announced that that is her last term. So what I'm trying to say is how people who go to Bilderberg end up being in top positions. And this could be the case with Olaf Scholz, but there are many other cases like
Macron. Well, there are. I mean, let me just say one thing about one of the attendees at the Bilderberg, who I met, a guy called Will Hutton. At the time, he was the editor of the Observer newspaper, the Guardian's Sunday edition newspaper. And a few weeks after attending Bilderberg, he wrote quite a scathing piece in the Observer about Bilderberg. So he then was made not the Observer editor anymore. And he's really fallen from any kind of position of power in British journalism. So, you know, obviously this is, you have to kind of play ball with them if you want to succeed.
Yeah, remember what Margaret Thatcher said. Margaret Thatcher said that the Bilderbergers kicked her out of being a British chancellor. You know, she said that the Bilderbergers killed her. That's what she said.
And she was probably right about that. Yeah, I mean, I think she was right. She said, for example, she was quite a fan of the old-fashioned common market, but she didn't want political union. And she said, I refuse to hand over this sovereign nation to 13 unelected bankers. Right. And maybe you can say now what you make of the way that Europe operates with the EU and the European Central Bank, having experienced a bit of, you know, the Eurozone yourself.
Yes, I mean, just to also mention this, I mean, Macron was at Bilderberg in 2014 in Copenhagen, and he is the president of France. Von der Leyen has attended at least four times the Bilderberg meeting, and she is now the head of the European Union.
Yeah, well, Macron, he was at Bilderberg in 2014. He was also a former employee of the Rothschilds Bank. And then he suddenly, in 2017, 3 years later, he's president. And he's doing little funny little jobs like flying over to Lebanon to tell the Lebanese, as the old colonial power, that they have to have a regime change. When it comes to von der Leyen, I think quite a lot of us were surprised last year when it was decided to make her president of Europe. And there were quite a few question marks about that from the European Parliament. But eventually, the whole thing came to nothing. They were questioning her. But, I mean, can you tell us a bit about von der Leyen and her background? We've heard all about Olaf Scholz. But what about von der Leyen, the woman who's now president of Europe?
Well, von der Leyen became EU president is a deal between Germany and France. You see, they kind of share power positions. So what happened was a French person got to be the head of the European Central Bank.
That's Christine Lagarde, who's also a former Bilderberger.
Absolutely. And so the French got with her the head of the central bank, which was and von der Leyen got the job of president of the EU. So this is a deal between the French and the Germans, right? Now von der Leyen is a typical example of a person who fails in their job but then moves up in the positions. It's incredible. I mean, as the Minister of Defense under Merkel, She absolutely ran the Bundeswehr, the German army, into the ground, which means that, for instance, I'll give you an example. Of 100 fighter planes, only 5 were operational. Of the 10 U-boats, only 2 were operational. And the list goes on. The German army didn't have any guns, and they used broomsticks in the maneuvers to simulate that they have a machine gun, which they painted black. They didn't have any munitions. The soldiers didn't have any boots to wear. They had to buy their own boots. So
they should buy some British boots. The British boots are best.
Yeah. Well, anyway, one scandal after the other of complete, dilettantes.
This is really important, Manfred, because, soldiers, for the armed forces to be of any use whatsoever, they've got to have a good morale. Now, if they're being starved of resources, if they're finding their tanks breaking down, the tracks falling off, the guns don't work, this is really bad for morale.
Absolutely, and not only for morale, it is also that they're not effective and a joke. I mean, all the other NATO members were joking about the German army, that they are a laughing stock, and it was for the German soldiers. It was really an awful situation how they were supplied or not supplied with the right equipment.
Yeah, but this is a bit perverse, isn't it? Because financially, Germany was very successful. In fact, one might say that the German finance system is almost like an army in it of itself, which was much more successful than the real army.
Yes, but they had completely wrong priorities, the government, the Merkel government. Don't forget that the Merkel government, Merkel is from her upbringing and from her, where she comes from, is a communist, is 100% communist. And her job is to destroy Germany. That was always her job. And that's what she has done.
Germany's done very well, Manfred, financially. Germany and the standard of living in Germany is very good.
No, it's not true that Germany is doing very well. It's like Germany is like a tanker. A tanker where the engine is out still continues for 20 miles until it stops. Not like a motorboat. A motorboat, if the engine stops, it stops in 30 feet, finished. But Germany is a tanker. It lives off the past, and therefore it was moving forward even if the engine is out, right? And that's what the job of America was, to destroy the industrial base, deindustrialize Germany, then bring in millions of migrants to destroy the culture of Germany, and with the lockdown also kill the automobile, the car industry, and also the energy industry. So they are doing everything to destroy Germany.
Well, yeah, but Germany's not the only country to have a lockdown. In fact, I think that in Europe, the Swedes are the only ones that didn't do that.
Yeah, the Swedes and the Belarusia, yeah. Anyway, well, the Sweden has been bashed by all the media in Europe and also in America and by the politicians that it was a bad example. But it has turned out, according to the latest news, because they have no more infections, they have no more COVID deaths, and the economy is booming, that Sweden did the right thing. And 50% of the population is now immune to the COVID-19 virus. So they did the correct thing, and all the other countries made a huge mistake by doing a lockdown and destroying their own economy, because that will cause more deaths than the COVID virus ever did, right? But anyway, we are talking about careers and Bilderberg and who is on the top. And this is an example of that. Now, the problem with the EU today is that Italy, but also Greece and Spain and France, they are really in trouble because of this lockdown. Italy has now lost a huge part of their GDP. It went from 120 before the lockdown to 160, the debt compared to the GDP. So they have a huge problem regarding debt, and that they don't earn enough taxes to pay for their interests and for everything. So what we will see is that Italy could go the way of Britain, that they will leave the EU, that they have to leave the EU to get out of this prison, which is called the common currency euro, because the common currency euro is killing all those countries that cannot devalue their currency, like Greece and Italy and Spain and France and Portugal, etc., etc., like they could before when they had their own currency. And that is a big problem for them. And it's not possible that Germany has to pay for everything. And because the taxes in Germany are so high already. And now with this 750 billion help aid packet, which the European Union worked out, Germany is paying most of it, which means they have to increase the taxes incredibly for the German people, which have record unemployment and record companies going bankrupt.
So is all this, do you think, I mean, it sounds awful, but do you think this is an accident or deliberate?
Absolutely deliberate. It's absolutely deliberate. Well, because the financial system of the dollar and also of the euro was already bankrupt and before collapse, before the lockdown, before the virus. But now all the things have been worsened tremendously, but the politicians have now the perfect excuse, because they can blame it on the virus if the euro goes bust and if everybody loses their job and the businesses are closed. And I mean, don't forget, in America, at least 40 million people have lost their jobs. Half the restaurants are not going to open. All the tourism industry is dead. Hotels, rent-a-cars, airlines, etc., resorts, they're all dead. And the same applies to Europe and things like that. So what they can do, what I predict, is that this year there will be a huge crash, financial crash, either before the election in November or after the election in November in America.
Also, we've now got Joe Biden has picked Kamala Harris to be his running mate as vice president against Donald Trump. How do you think that's all going to go?
That's very funny, because all the lefties and the so-called Democrats, they are the ones who want to defund the police, and they want to they are against the police, and they want to get rid of the whole police forces in America. But Kamala Harris is actually, she was a former a policeman. That means, you know, that's a big contradiction to how they are running their policies against the police, but they select Kamala Harris as a former police and security person as the vice president. I mean, she's known for that. That's why she was elected in Los Angeles. because she cleaned up the place and things like that, you know. But for me, definitely, she's going to run the show. I mean, Joe Biden has nothing to say. He's just a senile old man with 77 years who doesn't know what he's talking about. So Kamala Harris will be actually the real president. She is known for being hard with criminals, and she was the person in California who put all the people who were smoking marijuana into prison and things like that, which contradicts completely what the Democratic Party and the lefties and liberals and everybody wants to defund the police and not crack down on criminality in the cities, etc.
Well, is it interesting if she's so anti-drugs? I mean, you know, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because most of the Democrat voters, etc., understand that prohibition of drugs, all it really does is it helps the mafia.
Absolutely. You see, don't forget, there is no difference between the parties in America, just like there is no difference in the parties in Britain or in Germany or in anywhere in France. They're all the same. They all do the same thing when they're in power, because behind all the political parties are the real runners of the show. They're the ones who say what's going on. The political parties are just actors on stage, and the public sitting in front of the stage thinks they are the real people, but they're not the real people. They are just actors, and they follow the commands of the real rulers who you don't see and who are behind the curtains. It doesn't matter if the Democrats or if the Republicans are in power in Washington. The policy will be absolutely the same, and the policy is more wars, more expansion of the military, more security state. That's what it is, and Kamala Harris is an example of that, right? Donald Trump actually supported their re-election as Attorney General of Kamala Harris in 2014, and he wrote a check over $5,000, and I have a copy of it in front of me of this check, which means that from a political standpoint, there is not much difference between how Trump thinks and how Kamala Harris thinks. Although now they are kind of like in opposition. Isn't that interesting? That he supported her re-election with a $5,000 check. Look, this shows proofs for me that this whole thing is just a big show, that they're all in the same team. There is no difference. It's like having Pepsi Cola and Coca Cola. What's inside is the same. They just have different labels on the bottle.
I suppose the big question, though, has got to be: do you think there'll be some sort of a fighting war, or just an economic collapse? Which do you think is going to happen first, or what are your thoughts?
Well, the economic collapse will absolutely come first. And then, just like it happened after the Great Depression, 1929, 1930, there will be a war following up, because that's the only way politicians think that they can get out of that hole, that they do a war to unite the country against a common enemy, to get the production going and the businesses going and the people employed.
When the common enemy is a banker?
Well, it can't be a banker, because the bankers run the place. They're the ones behind everything. It has to be an outside enemy. It has to be China, right? Or somebody, Russia. They're the bad guys. Iran are the bad guys. Venezuela are the bad guys.
But surely nobody wants a war.
Look, up to Pearl Harbor, 80% of the American people who were asked in polls if they want, if America should join the European war, said, no, we don't want to do anything, and we don't want to send our soldiers to the European war theater. And then Pearl Harbor happened, which the American government let happen, as we know. They let it happen because they knew the Japanese were going to attack. So they let it happen, and then they had the perfect excuse to declare war on Japan. And from one day to the next, the people changed their mind, and they, in millions, they went to join the army to fight the Japs and the Germans. So this is how you do it.
Some people have suggested that one of the reasons Sweden might have been given a different formula to deal with the coronavirus, a very successful one, is because they've been very good in their economy, if you could say the word good, in making the cashless society and having microchips in the people.
Yes, not only that, they're the perfect example of a new world order country. They're the perfect example, not only because what you mentioned regarding cashless society, but also the flood of migrants, which is absolutely a new world order policy, and feminism, extreme feminism. I mean, the whole government is only women. There are no men anymore, and things like that. So they are, it could be that you're right, that they were told, because you are such good followers of our new world order, we will allow you that you don't have to do the lockdown, and therefore your economy is spared. That could be, yes.
How do people find your blog?
Well, if you Google, or if you use a search engine and enter Alles, A-L-L-E-S, Schall, S-C-H-A-L-L, und, U-N-D, and then Rauch, R-A-U-C-H, Alles, Schall und Rauch, All Smoke and Mirrors in English, you can find my blog, and there you will see over 5,000 articles and YouTube videos, etc., about the political situation, about Europe, about the wars, about the economy, about the financial situation, also about what you can do regarding preparing for a financial crash. How you can prepare yourself and survive this loss, because what will happen is that the governments will absolutely take everything away from you. They will confiscate your cash from the banks. They will confiscate your houses. I mean, that's all been done in the past. This is nothing new.
You quite correctly predicted Olaf Scholz's rise to power, and it looks as if he may well become, I think it's in September next year, to September 21, the new German Chancellor. And if he does, I think that you deserve a big pat on the back for that.
Well, I mean, I'm not writing these things to predict and then be have a right prediction. These are just logical assumptions that I do, adding one and one together and connecting the dots and learning from history and watching patterns where then you can come out with these predictions. So it's not only that I predicted Olaf Scholz will come up on top, but also that I think, which is for me much more worrisome and important, that we are really looking into a big financial crash situation in the next few months. And that, and I can only ask people to prepare themselves regarding stocking up on food and maybe buying gold and looking how you can survive losing your job and losing everything. And that money, we will run into a huge inflation. So the money will not be worth anything. I mean, look where gold is now. It went through $2,000 an ounce. and things like that, right? So that's for me very worrisome, and that's what I've been doing in the last 2 weeks here in my refugium in Abkhazia. I've been doing preparation. For instance, I installed in my house a solar power system, so I'm now independent from a grid, electric grid, and I produce my own electricity.
Ah, so you weren't just doing the gardening?
No, I was also doing other productive things, and I was also, you know, expanding all my vegetable garden and also, you know, harvesting the stuff. And because it's so much, I have to put it into glasses, you know, how do you call it, conserve it?
Yeah,
and things like that.
Well, yeah. It sounds to me like you're pretty happy there off-grid with some lovely mountains behind you and a beautiful black sea in front of you. Manfred Petrich, thanks very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. See you soon. Bye-bye.
So that's Manfred Petrich there. Rather idyllic circumstances, Martin, and he's even wealthy enough to buy some gold too, which we both had a little bit of a laugh about. Neither of us are able to do things like that. But you take his point, I think, about the main point he's making there about, and it's probably worth, I think we should immediately correct one of the errors he made there, which is about the Swedish cabinet, because it is... No, it's not all women. I understand this is a sort of rhetorical thing he's saying there, but it's not. There's 12 women and 11 men, so it's mainly women, but it's certainly not all women. And so that was an exaggeration. But his main point that he's making, and I think it was really fascinating to get his tale about what happened at Sitges in Portugal in 2010, when the Bilderbergers were sort of tricked in a way into thinking that they were, because they were 2 kilometres away from the highway in a forest in the middle of nowhere having their meeting, that nobody would be able to get pictures. What happened was we had a kind of a telephoto lens commando photographer managed to commando crawl his way just within sight of the door on the Sunday, got pictures of every single one of them, which is an absolutely fantastic tale. And obviously this guy was one of those who may well not have been on that list, which was released in those days after the conference, and he was obviously the main person really involved in all of this, his name being Olaf Scholz, who will be taking over, it seems, from Chancellor Merkel next year in 13 months time in September 2021.
Well, he will if the SPD do well enough for him to be the Chancellor.
Well,
his
point is that Merkel is making the Christian Democrats she's not doing very well for them, and that there's likely to be some sort of a backlash, which is understandable, isn't it?
Yeah, but because they've got a proportional system, the SPD are now polling less than the Green Party. So it's quite possible that the Greens will be nominating the Chancellor, not the SPD. So you can't presume... I know that Bilderberg has a lot of power, and we know that up and coming politicians end up being roped in to go to visit, to go and join in, like Tony Blair was, although he denied he was going there. But the idea that there's a straightforward process from going to Bilderberg and ending up as chancellor
some people say that the Bilderberg control Western politics. They don't. They influence it to an immense extent, and they are basically chess players trying to make sure that their chess piece is in the right place at the right time. And if all things go well for them, then they will be in control of the major positions in the country. Anyway, this guy Olaf Scholz, ex-mayor of Hamburg, etc., Bilderberger, who looks to be, I mean, certainly the polls, looking at the polls, Martin, after his name was announced, it does look as if he's atop of the polls to be next Chancellor after Merkel too. But it's just quite, I think, brilliant that Manfred predicted his rise to power way back in 2010. And it just proves, really, what we've been saying over the years, with characters like Margaret Thatcher being booted out by Bilderberg, Tony Blair being fast-tracked into power by Bilderberg, and same with Bill Clinton, same with Emmanuel Macron. You know, of course, Macron is a perfect character, really, because he came almost out of nowhere, Martin, didn't he, to win the presidential election in France.
Yes, all of this is true. We know that there are factions of wealthy corporations and individuals intelligence services, deep state manipulating politics. And plenty of people, I mean, I tell you who hasn't been invited to Bilderberg would be Jeremy Corbyn. And this is the
or Donald Trump, by the way.
Oh, no, yes, indeed. And so, in other words, the Bilderberg group have got an agenda which is Atlanticist.
David Cameron was.
Yes, it's an Atlanticist agenda. So they exclude the what they would regard as the extreme left, i.e. Corbyn, and what they regard as the extreme right, i.e. Trump.
Having had some experience of these people, there's a really caustic atmosphere with them. Basically, if you don't think like we do, you know, you may as well be shoved off a cliff. They are very, very strict on, you know, you basically just got to think like we do. And if you think like we do, you'll get ahead.
Yeah, but they're in a position to help politicians get elected. But of course, ultimately, the electorate decides. And the electorate, sadly, are often impressed by people who've got track records of being in a senior position in Hamburg, going to Bilderberg. Most people in this country still haven't heard about Bilderberg.
Well, what about...
It doesn't really make an influence.
What about people who've quashed child abuse proceedings and things like that? Because this is where the Bilderbergers media contingent comes in absolutely key here, because you've got journalists who go in there and editors and general managers of massive media networks that go to Bilderberg, and then actually they're swearing secrecy on the moment they step over the threshold. So their loyalty is to Bilderberg. It's not to the listeners. It's to Bilderberg and their own shareholders, I guess. And they're thinking that, well, if I carry on and follow the Bilderberg policies, my shareholders will be happy with me and hang the audience.
Yes, that's true. And we know that the media is in the pocket of powerful forces. But certain politicians would never be invited to Bilderberg. And other politicians wouldn't want to go even if they were invited. And Bilderberg, as you say, has got an agenda, which is an Atlanticist agenda. When he's talking there about Merkel being a communist, she was born in East Germany, which is a research scientist. The deindustrialization of Germany is definitely proceeding, but in actual fact, the Eurozone is very good for German industry. It's rubbish for Italian industry, but it can't be, both things can't be true.
Yeah, well.
It can't be a deindustrialization. The Eurozone, in fact, has protected German industry. And the Eurozone, in fact, has led to situations like Greece, for example, having to pay to the German banking system massive amounts of money, which have propped up the living standards of average Germans at the expense of the Greeks.
So back in the 1990s, when John Smith, the Labour leader, was invited to the Bilderberg conference, I've heard anecdotally that he was livid with their analysis of economics. And he said, well, next year I'm going to bring Brian Gould and let him lecture you a bit on economics. Unfortunately, there never was a next year for John Smith, and he died.
Yeah, well, 2 weeks before he died, he made a speech to the Socialist International in Geneva, which is in Switzerland, where Manfred's from, and he said, we're going to have to abolish the IMF and the World Bank.
Well, Prince Charles is saying the same now.
Well, ultimately, they probably will be abolished, but what will happen is that the powers that be will recreate something similar, even if it's called something else.
Which would you prefer, a John Smith version of the IMF and the World Bank, or Prince Charles version?
Well, I don't really... leave Prince Charles out of it.
He's in charge of the Great Reset. He's also made a lot of money from carbon trading, as was revealed in the Panama Papers. He's taken a great stake in the world's financial future.
He is a very powerful individual, but he is not as powerful as, the head of the CIA. He just isn't. It's ridiculous to pretend so.
He's an extremely wealthy individual too. So, I mean, I would imagine that he's quite close to the bankers. He's also quite close to the top European aristocracy.
Yes, you know, all right. And there is definitely a conspiracy by the powerful to stay powerful. But, of course, what's really interesting is where they disagree with each other. Anyway, for example, over Belarus, which you mentioned earlier, it looks as if Hungary and other countries are going to be out of line with what NATO wants to do. And that's because the really interesting thing is when they don't agree and they can't agree, and that's because there's a crisis of capitalism where ultimately everybody can't win. Somebody has to be a loser.
Well, it's like herding cats, isn't it? Trying to control massive amounts of area with just a tiny number of people behind the scenes. Anyway, this German finance minister, Olaf Scholz, had something to say recently on Brexit. I think it was towards the end of last year, but I thought it'd be interesting to try and... It took me a little while, but I managed to dig out what he thinks about Brexit, which obviously is quite a key international issue for Europe.
they would suffer a lot if there would be a hard Brexit. It's good also for Europe because there is some uncertainty which is related to a hard Brexit. We are prepared for that. Mostly in the financial sector, there will be no problems because anything is done and it's more virtual. You can do it easily. The bigger problems are coming from the supply chain of goods in Europe, because there is already something where a car that is produced at 40 places and it's going back and forth. And if you interrupt this supply chain, this has a negative impact on economic growth. So I would be very happy if we will not have to suffer from those problems.
Well, it sounds like Merkel pick shifted, you know, basically just coming out of the same old stuff. I mean, I'm reminded of what Manfred was saying about, you know, it's either Pepsi Cola or Coca-Cola.
Well, I think there's a question to be answered. Hard or soft Brexit? And that's what Schultz, as the finance minister, was addressing. Hard Brexit will have economic consequences.
So they better negotiate something good, hadn't they?
And it'd be interesting to hear your opinion, Tony. Do you want a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit?
I've really no idea.
Well, surely you need to think about it. Because
No. I'm here just to commentate on the circumstances. I don't have a preference.
You were in favour of Brexit?
Of course.
So do you want a hard one or a soft one?
No. I don't know.
I'd be in favour of a soft one, and there's plenty of economic arguments in favour of that.
I don't think, you know, I don't have the ability to sit down as if I was at the negotiating table. I would prefer, obviously, to have some sort of deal. You know, I'd like to see a deal because I'd like to see
a soft Brexit.
I like people making an agreement. Well, maybe halfway between a soft and a hard, maybe something like that. Well, but it really isn't. It really isn't for me to say, Martin. I know you're trying to bounce me into an answer there.
Listen, you can be a journalist sometimes, and sometimes you're going to be a political activist, and you've got to decide where you're going.
I mean, actually, I don't think it makes a blind bit of difference, because at the end of the day, there will be something decided. Now, I've got no control over whatsoever. The main reason and I'm interested in, and I'd like to see a Brexit, is because I don't agree with the totalitarian nature of Europe and the way the EU is operating. I would much rather that Britain, you know, when people cast a vote in Britain, that it makes some difference about our future. I'd also like to see us controlling our financial policy, and I'd like us to have an industrial policy of our own, control our trade policy, which was lost when we joined the common market under Ted Heath.
Okay, well, I mean, that is an argument in favour of a hard Brexit. But all the negatives...
Well, I think we need to have negotiations.
All the negatives
we need
of a hard
to negotiate
Brexit.
Too, yeah? So, I mean, I'm someone who likes to see a compromise wherever possible.
Okay.
Anyway, so let's have a listen.
Let's see what happens. It's going to be a hard Brexit anyway.
You think so? Why?
Yeah, because that's what the right wing of the Tory party want, and they've got a majority of 80, even though their electoral systems are rubbish.
Is that not because the EU don't really want to negotiate and they want to cause as much trouble as possible?
No, you've got 27 other countries in the EU who have agreed the single market. Britain has got to decide whether it wants to be in the single market or not. It's quite a simple decision. Norway and Switzerland, Manfred's old country, are both in the single market. If we leave the single market, we're the only country in Europe not in the single market, apart from Iceland. And the consequences for the car industry and various other things are going to be dire. And, of course, that's what's going to happen, because we've got a Tory party government that wants to do that. But the consequences will be dire, and there will be political consequences flowing from the economic consequences.
And I think also the consequences are being dire for many countries who are having to stay in the Eurozone as well.
Yes, the Eurozone is probably going to break up. I don't think the Italians will leave the EU. They will leave the Euro.
But they can't. They're not going to be allowed to. They've got a technocratic government. And the guy that wanted to create an alternative currency in Italy was bounced out, wasn't he?
Yeah, but what you'll find is that the middle class in Italy, as in Greece, do not want to leave the European Union. They want to leave the Euro. And of course, this compromise that's been cobbled up, where the, you know, some money is going to be given by the Germans, the Austrians, and the so-called frugal countries to bail out the southern Europeans, it won't work. There isn't enough money in there to make it worth their while to stay inside the Euro. So what will happen is probably Britain will crash out of the EU and out of the single market, which will have drastic effects. For us and for our neighbours.
Well, it won't be exactly a surprise, will it?
No, but it'll have drastic effects. The car industry here, the Association of Motor Manufacturers, has basically spelled it out. The Ellesmere port plant is going to go to Spain. Nissan are going to withdraw from Sunderland. All of that is going to happen.
Well, surely, you know, in order to build cars to sell in Britain, then maybe we'll see a British car industry resurgent, because there's not a single British car is built now actually made from a British company.
No, well, in actual fact...
In Bristol, specialist cars, they might do.
As the finance minister of Germany just explained, a car is built in 40 different countries now. Yeah, things have changed since the 1970s.
They're getting a bit more expensive. They might have to go electric too.
Well, yes, and it may be that there won't be any car industry at all in this country, which will be very devastating for many parts of the country.
Which I've been predicting. If it sounds crazy, I mean, don't blame me. It's because if we have a financial crash and crisis with various vehicles that are petrol and diesel powered, and we also find it difficult to get these things, petrol and diesel, from the Middle East because of a war or whatever, all those vehicles may be useless, may be put on the scrap heap. You know, that would be a way of boosting the car industry, so everyone would have to buy a new car.
Yeah, but at the same time, of course, the price of oil is being forced down because of the deflationary pressures in the world economy. Anyway,
but if there's a war, it'll go up a bit, Martin.
Oh, yeah, well, if there's a war, it'll go
just
up
a bit.
Yeah. And of course, what may happen is a financial crash, which will probably start in the US, which will blow everything out of the water anyway. So all of the fiddling around Brexit will be a minor matter when Barclays Bank collapses. And that could easily happen. So we're not going to be talking about Brexit. We're going to be talking about the ATMs aren't going to be working anymore.
Bank is not going to collapse while KPMG are doing their audit, is it?
Well, the point is that all of the banking system is completely vulnerable to a collapse. We know that from 2008.
They're going to choose it at their own time, I think.
Well, exactly. So that's, anyway, can that's we just what go COVID's back, all about.
Go back.
Penultimate item
tonight is about the Russiagate scandal. And here is a guy called Dan Bugino talking about Russiagate. And that is, he reckons there were two plans, Plan A and Plan B. And see what you make of this, Martin. This is, at least he alleges, the real inside track of what was really going on in Russiagate. Well, we do know, don't we, that Craig Murray was involved in all this, in getting the emails from the Democratic National Committee over to the UK and being published by WikiLeaks. But this is the story of what was going on, apparently anyway, at the National Security Agency in the States.
The Obama administration figures out that through unmasking, in other words, wiretapping people, pretending they're targeting foreigners, and then querying information in this database, that they can get all the political opposition research in the world that they need against the Trump team. It's beautiful. No one's going to call them out. The media's on their side, right? But there's a good guy in this. There's a white hat. Somebody in the government sniffs this thing out. That's why I tell you, this wasn't Plan A. This was the plan. They were going to unmask people, wiretap people, and they were going to query this NSA database and get all the information they needed about the Trump team. But somebody smells a problem, and he's not having it. And he's the white hat. He's the good guy in this story. And it's Mike Rogers of the NSA. Mike Rogers of the NSA senses that there's something wrong about these about queries. In other words, who's tapping into the database here and making political queries? Now, folks, some of you, I don't know your politics. I assume most of you are conservative, libertarian, or Republican, but that's fine either way. If you doubt any of what I'm telling you, just Google the FISA Intelligence Surveillance Court, their report on about queries. Because Mike Rogers goes to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and says, Houston, we got a problem. These queries are supposed to follow very specific guidelines about terrorism and all these metrics have to be. You can't just spy on Americans in the database. The FISA court looks into it, comes back with a report that was released in March of 2017. Ladies and gentlemen, that is devastating. If you haven't read it, you are doing yourself a great disservice. Page 80 specifically is horrifying. Apparently, the NSA database was being queried by private contractors working with the FBI. These were not even government officials. People within the government were using private contractors to query information they had no judicial or legal authority whatsoever to look at. Rogers smells a rat. People panic in the government. Now, conveniently, what happens right after the election? I'm going to put these pieces together and things will start to make sense. Donald Trump's elected. He's the president-elect, right? 10 days after the election, Rogers, who knows this has been going on the whole time, these unmaskings, the tapping of the... Now does the Donald Trump tweet, they tap Trump Tower, now does it make sense? He got the wording wrong. He didn't understand exactly how it worked, but the idea was not wrong. Donald Trump's not stupid, trust me. Guy got elected president, earned $1 billion. By the way, I love how these journalists criticize him. Journalist, the guy's making $25,000 a year writing clickbait pieces for BuzzFeed. And like, Donald Trump's an idiot. Hard pass, brother. Like, well, the guy just won the president. He runs for office the first time and he becomes the president. But we're, yeah, let me listen to Joey Bag of Donuts at BuzzFeed. You're right. You've got this. It's like, so about 10 days after the election, Donald Trump, someone goes up to visit Donald Trump in Trump Tower. Who visits him? Mike Rogers. But Rogers doesn't tell anyone. This is going to trip you out totally. He doesn't tell anybody in the White House he's going up there. He visits Trump in Trump Tower, conveniently 10 days after the election, which from my experience in the Secret Service is just enough time for them to go up to Trump Tower, WACA, the White House Communications Agency, for the president-elect, and set up a SCIF where they can talk privately, a sensitive compartmentalized information facility. In other words, a place where no one can listen in. Rogers gives it about 10 days, goes up there, has this big meeting with Donald Trump, and what happens the very next day? Donald Trump evacuates Trump Tower and goes to Bedminster, New Jersey to never return for another meeting. You think that was a coinkydink? Like he did that by accident? Oh, let's just go up to Bedminster. I got nothing else to do. Now, again, this is all in the book in intricate detail. The greatest spy story ever told, except the fact that it actually happened. And it happened against you. Rogers has this meeting. Trump evacuates Trump Tower. The very next day, the Obama administration comes out and calls for somebody to be fired. Who's that somebody? Mike Rogers. And they start blaming it on things like drone strikes and other stuff. Like, really? Could you be any more obvious? The Obama administration knows Rogers is the good guy and fills Trump in on this entire debacle. He probably goes up there and says, brother, they're spying on you, like right now. He doesn't know, but now he does. So he leaves. All of a sudden, people start resigning from the federal government after that. You know who also resigns? Bob Hannigan. Now, who's Bob Hannigan? Bob Hannigan is the head of the GCHQ, which is the British NSA. Well, why do you think the head of the British NSA would resign right after that Rogers meeting, right after Trump finds out about this massive spying operation? I'm going to tell you why right now. I'm not taking a selfie of you. I'm not taking a selfie of myself. I'm going to read to you a headline. This is from CNN. See it right there. I didn't Photoshop this. April 14th, 2017. Remember who Bob Hannigan is. He's the head of the British NSA. British intelligence passed Trump associates' communications with Russians on to U.S. counterparts. You think I'm making this up? That's CNN. I didn't write it. They wrote that. So not only is the United States government in Plan A weaponizing its intelligence community to listen in and computer search the Trump team to hurt them during the campaign for political oppo, they're working with the British and the Australians to pass information about the Trump team onto the Obama administration. Don't take it from me. Take it from CNN. They find out about this. Now, this thing breaks down about halfway through. They move on to Plan B. Sorry, there's a lot more to Plan A, but I, in the interest of time, I want to get through this because the cleanup operation is important. They move on to Plan B. What's Plan B? They realize Rogers is onto them. They're like, hey, folks, we better ease up on the unmasking and the tapping into the database. People are getting caught. This is probably not good. We're leaving a massive paper trail. And what if we lose, right? They move on to Plan B. Plan B's Crossfire Hurricane. They say, well, listen, if we can't spy on them illegally, let's just spy on them legally. We have this beautiful thing called the FISA court, where we can walk into the FISA court, we can get a warrant on somebody, and when you get a warrant on somebody in the Trump team, they have this beautiful thing for the Obama administration called the two-hop rule. Well, it's for everyone, that's for Obama. Meaning, if I spy on you, and you're a member of the Trump team, I can hop to everybody you emailed and then everybody they email. So basically, all I need to do is get a FISA warrant on the guy cleaning the floors in Trump Tower, and I've got everyone. Because if he emailed his boss and his boss emailed Don Jr., I get everybody. Beautiful, right? Not really. Because they were stupid. They were dumb. And they screwed up. The problem with the FISA court, unlike the unmaskings and the tapping into the database, is they had to produce actual evidence in front of a judge. There was a judge in a FISA court that needed evidence that the Trump team was working on behalf of a foreign power, but critically doing it in violation of at least one U.S. law. Folks, they had nothing. They had zero. Do you understand they, to this day, have absolutely zero, zero. Remember, don't do it one hand. It's a big mistake. Media people, you'll be a white power person after that. You always do it that way. They had zero evidence at all. I'm only half kidding. That's how worried I am about the media. They're so crazy these days, right? They had nothing on collusion. Nothing. Zero. So what does the FBI and the State Department and the DOJ do? They say, well, we don't really have any evidence. Let's just make it up. We've got this guy we worked with in the past, this guy Christopher Steele. Now I'm going to do this. I'm not taking a selfie again. I'm not taking a picture of you. Don't you worry. I'm going to read to you another headline. You need to write this down because this one's going to blow your mind. Any of you read the dossier? You haven't, right? Not many people have. You should. If you haven't read the dossier, don't you worry. Because the dossier was already written back on April 17th of 2007. You're like, what do you mean? I don't get it. Even 2017, right? No. I didn't get that wrong. It's written right here in the Wall Street Journal on April 17th, 2007. Who's the author of this critical Wall Street Journal piece? Glenn Simpson and Mary Jacoby, his wife. Glenn Simpson, the purveyor of Fusion GPS. The article is called How Lobbyists Help Ex-Soviets Woo Washington. Folks, I dare you to take a moment and read that piece. Put it next to the dossier. It's the same thing.
So that's Dan Bugino, Martin. He's the author of a book called Spygate, The Attempted Sabotage of Donald J. Trump, Dan Bugino, and W.C. McAllister with Matt Palumbo. They're basically saying that there was an attempt by the Obama administration to use the National Security Agency to spy on the Trump campaign, which backfired effectively because it was somebody actually in the NSA, a government official, that called them out in the FISA court. And they then went into various different Plan A, Plan B, Plan C. I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the full interview. But it sounds to me, what he's saying there is very clear. The British were very much involved as well, using GCHQ to do much of this spying.
Yeah, and it's probably got some linkage to the so-called Skripal case, because Christopher Steele was, Skripal was possibly the source of the story, for example, that Obama had paid prostitutes to pee on Trump's bed in when he'd been in Moscow.
See, maybe this was just made up, but Skripal was supposed to be the source.
Yep.
And he was told, if anyone asks you, tell us you, as a Russian spy, said this, you know.
Well, I think the fact is that all of this stuff about the Russians are the handlers of Trump and that Trump's basically a Russian puppet is just Democratic Party nonsense. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. And, of course, the main allegation that the DNC committee was rigging the primary process in pre-2016 election to keep Bernie Sanders out was absolutely true. And the defence of the deep state in the US is, yes, it's true, but it was the Russians who leaked it, and therefore the Russians are responsible for the fact that we're trying to rig the Democratic primaries. And, of course, the people laughing and cheering and all that stuff are super, super Trump supporters. So the whole idea that the state can spy on us too, I feel like saying, don't you realise the deep state is spying on everybody? What makes you think that because you're the Trump campaign that they ain't going to spy on you? I mean, supposedly the rules say they can't, but, of course, they do. and they spy on everybody, and they've been doing it for years. And of course, these privileged Americans get really, oh my God, they spied on us. It's like, yes, of course they do. They spy on everybody.
This is a little bit Watergate-like, though, isn't it? Using the security services to fix an election, upcoming election, because you're in government at the time, you can influence that upcoming
Well, as
election.
You know, Tony, the real story of Watergate is that they wanted Nixon out. And in actual fact, the deep state removed Nixon because they weren't happy with various aspects of what he was doing.
Henry Kissinger stayed in.
Yes. Well, there you go. I mean, people getting kind of faux shocked about all of this stuff. It kind of amazes me. You know, after
it's not faux, is it? No, we want to have it. Martin, just a minute. It's not just. It's a pretty provocative thing to say faux shocked. We do actually believe in the rule of law, and it's quite clear from what he was saying there that this guy, Mike Rogers, believed in the rule of law, and it was him that stopped the Obama administration from spying on the Trump campaign.
Well, it's Binney who used to head up the.
But only after Trump had won the election. That's the irony. It's only because Trump won that this ever came out.
Yeah, well, Binney, who used to head up the NSA, he analysed the WikiLeaks leak, and he said that was definitely taken away on a memory stick because of the speed by which it was downloaded. Okay? Now, if you look back to the 1980s, the COINTELPRO operations going back to the 1960s against the left wing in US politics, including the assassination of JFK, RFK, the Martin Luther King, and during that period, the right wing in US politics were absolutely happy for the deep state to do anything it's necessary to keep control of the country. And then they get, as I say, faux upset when the same mechanisms and techniques are used against them. Because, of course, they're not supposed to be used against them. They're supposed to be used against the enemy. So then they get upset about it. Of course, Trump won the election, but he didn't win most votes. It's an American system. He got 3 million less votes, but he ends up being the president.
Well, the same happens here, doesn't it?
It does.
Unfortunately, anyway. But not in Germany, where everything's hunky-dory. Anyway, we're going to listen now to our final clip, which is from John Paul Rice. We heard a bit from him last week. And this is really about the evil in Hollywood and the way that Hollywood has moved towards becoming, you know, this predatory beast, effectively. We heard earlier on, didn't we, Martin, about the two campaigns, We Make Events and Light in Red, to do with the entertainment industry. Well, you know, when the live entertainment industry is gone, all you really have is TV and Hollywood. And what he's saying is, Jean-Paul Rice, is that what we've got left is this kind of really rather pernicious culture which Hollywood is churning out. What do you make of Hollywood, Martin, before we hear this clip anyway?
Well, Hollywood has been embedded in the deep state in the US since its inception decades ago. And it's been involved in all sorts of propaganda. And we all know that the CIA and the military are brought in to vet film scripts and so on. And of course, at the same time, it's lambasted on the right in US politics for pushing what they regard as a anti-family agenda, etc. What they're talking about is the success of film stars who look rather better than the average
population. UK here, it's probably worth mentioning that it was the big US networks that closed down things like our own Homebred, the Rank organization, in the 1950s and 60s, making some fantastic films and owning their own chain of cinemas. The United States chains like Odeon, etc., refused to show any of the Rank films, and eventually, financially, British film industry was squeezed out.
Yeah, it's called America First, is what Trump got elected with for doing. You know, that's what he's saying. We America First.
Okay, John Paul Rice
that,
now.
You know, that means our industry, not yours.
John Paul Rice now.
These kids, when you see Britney Spears, when you see Amanda Bynes, when you see any of these young pop stars have meltdowns, that's not because they're famous. That's not because of the pressures of stardom and the money getting to them. It's because they're sexually abused and handed around like candy. You go on Crazy Days and Nights, you can go to Tracy Beans channel and look up that video which she did at the end of 2019. It'll blow your mind. They have a pipeline of kids going from Haiti all the way to the Vatican on boats. And there are people in Hollywood who facilitate all this, stars who will go and date rich men. You can look up these stories are in the press. They're hidden like they're traveling and they're going over here. They're hanging out with billionaire men in the Middle East. Has nothing to do with the fact that they're Muslim. It's not even that they're Muslim. These are kings. These are princes. These are heads of state, dignitaries, billionaire moguls, all hanging around Khan. And it's legitimate. It's completely legitimate. They call it yachting. And that's just the dating part of it and having sex for money, which they throw hundreds of thousands of dollars at some of these girls, depending on how long they'll stay with them and accompany them to dinners and have sex with them and do whatever they want in their orgies or whatever sexual perversions they have. This has been going on for decades. Hollywood is just the most publicly visible because it's out in our faces. It's on our airways. It's on our TV all the time. It's in our music industry. You would not believe the level of satanic crap that is in there. And if you had told me this 3 years ago, I would have said, you're crazy. I thought, you know, that's too far. No. This satanic shit that is going on in our music industry and in Hollywood too, but mostly in the music industry, is so out there. Once you look at it and you see the occult symbolism, they use it in everything. Baphomet is everywhere. Pentagram is all over the place. And they sew it into the consciousness of these young kids through witchcraft and all sorts of fun stuff. They make it fun. They make it sound fun. And it's sexy. But I'll give you this, just on the practical level. You look at every pop star over the last 20 years, and especially in the last 10, Ariana Grande, Miley Cyrus, where do they start? Innocence. Miley Cyrus was Hannah Montana. Innocence. She came out with a music video last year for what? Where she had claws and teeth on her vagina. They promote diversity, tolerance, all of this to confuse people, and they don't even see it. Ariana Grande, unfortunately, I feel very bad for these kids because they're children and they have to do horrific things. Kaia Jones, who I know personally, was a former member of the Pussycat Dolls. And she gave her testimony in 2017, right after the Las Vegas shooting, because she was there. And she started talking as far as she could go about what these kids go through. And her moment of clarity was she saw what everybody else around her in the group was starting to do. Sex was nothing. But then taking advantage of people and having no remorse for it, she saw another level to it. And it was the moment she was at the MGM Grand, standing up there singing, and these young girls looking up and idolizing these women. You're the Pussycat Dolls. I want to be like you. She couldn't do it anymore, and she walked away. We can have truthful art in this world. We don't need propaganda. Truthful art begins with the diversity of ideas and truthful information being disclosed. We can have beautiful films. We can have honest expressions in it that come from within us. The journey of art is to discover what is within you that is the unknown, which you follow a belief to find. But in that discovery, there is the transcendent, which is what did I struggle with and come to confront within myself that I needed to release and share and let you decide what is real, what is true for you in that honest expression. But the other stuff, which is I'm going to tell you what you should think, and these are the bad people, and these are the good people, and this is what you need to think, and this is what you need to do, and everybody just gets all excited about that. That is the same stuff that we've been doing for so very long. And Hollywood, I will tell you this, if you look back why there's reboots, remakes, prequels, and sequels, I've discussed this with many of my writer friends in Hollywood who were deeply embedded trying to help get the truth out through the disclosure in their movies. They all told me what the gatekeepers all know at the very, very top, not the executives, not the agents, not the managers. It's like a banking institution. The person at the teller working with the customer does not have privy to the knowledge of the CEO and the chairman of the board and what they discussed the day before. They're just doing their job, right? So everybody does their job according to what they know. So Hollywood gets the word out through the studios. This is the kind of content we're looking for. But the gatekeepers at the very top are managers to make sure that we don't wake up. They control everything that we see, and it is very important for them to do that because they don't need you and I starting to have new ideas about things that go outside of the orthodoxy of what they want us to know. So the reboots, remakes, prequels, and sequels is like a holding pattern so that we keep retreading through the same ideas, even though as humans, our minds are to expand, to grow, to stretch, to reach out. And we're in a time where we're trapped between everything that we're supposed to do. There's so much cognitive dissonance. It's a reflection of this whole system which preys on children. That is the number one Achilles heel of this entire time.
Yeah, so that's John Paul Rice. Martin, again, you know, this is really focusing on going back to what I was saying before. We've got a live events industry in this country which has been crushed. Now we've got a music industry which is all pre-recorded stuff, which is all COVID-friendly, that's being foisted on people.
Well, I mean, that was an analysis of what he thinks is going on in Hollywood. As we know, people like Marilyn Monroe were probably assassinated. I don't think it's too controversial to suggest that.
That's a very long time ago.
I mean, well, I know, but I'm just saying it's been going on for a long time, as
well,
he says.
Yeah, but it's also, no, I mean, the satanic stuff hasn't, though, has it?
Well, I mean, the satanic stuff, I
he's talking about imagery in the pop world.
Yeah,
which
all right,
is,
well, if we're making specific allegations of sexual abuse, you don't have to mix in all of this kind of cultural criticism stuff. Now, he wants to bring it in there. He didn't say, I'm a Christian and satanic abuse is what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about abuse, any kind of abuse, satanic or otherwise.
I mean, his point really is that we've had all this stuff about the Me Too movement and the abuse of women, but nobody wants to go there when it comes to the kids.
Well, underlying all of this is the blackmail of all senior politicians and executives by the deep state. The Franklin case, you'll be familiar with, Tony, in the US. And also, of course, what's been going on here with the King Cora Boys Home in Northern Ireland. We know that the deep state uses abuse of children as part of its blackmail
and something
techniques.
Manfred was saying earlier on is that actually that is the purpose of the intelligence services, is largely to come up with a whole load of blackmail of politicians to keep control files on anyone that might get into power.
Not just politicians, also senior industrialists and all the rest of it.
Yeah, civil servants, all sorts.
So when I was saying about the control
files on anyone that matters.
Yes, that's right. So the previous clip we had with the guy getting they're spying on us. It's like, yes, of course they're spying on you. They spy on everybody because they want control of everybody, and it's been going on for a very long time. And of course we're now reaching the apogee of all of these things. The deep state in the US has basically become the open state. That used to be that all of these things happened in the shadows. It's now even carried out in front of our eyes. And that's because, you know, the powerful are powerful and they don't give up their power that easily.
Well, it's not really happening in front of our eyes necessarily when it's being censored, is it?
Well, no, what they're doing is manipulating the narrative for everybody. And, we know that there's all sorts of things going on. And we know specific things. I mean, when is the US going to face up to the fact that it's murdered its own president in 1962 and nobody's ever been punished? When are people in Britain going to face up to the fact that the British Army in Northern Ireland were running the Ulster Defence Association's terrorism programme? They orchestrated it. When are the Italian people going to face up to the fact that their Prime Minister Aldo Moro was kidnapped by the state, and the same state that bombed Piazza Fontana and Bologna in 1980?
Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel then?
Well, what's happening now with modern media, we've had a four-hour show here, and we've covered loads and loads of ground, but of course you couldn't do that 20 years ago, right? So we can talk about all these things and somebody will listen to it. But of course, back in the day, you only had the mainstream media to get your information from. Now, that doesn't mean that we're in that much of a better state, because of course the mainstream media has got an even louder voice than it had before, and so we're allowed to sit here in this place and say a few things.
No, I'm not sure
we're not really
going
to make that much difference, are we?
Well, I'm not so sure about that, because we discussed this last week a bit, didn't we, about the idea that once you start putting too much propaganda out people start switching off, don't they?
Well, I suppose that's one of the reasons why we do this show, is because we think there's some purpose in it, otherwise why would we bother? But nevertheless, it's an unequal struggle, as we know.
Let me just say one thing I think about the way forward, which is the amazing work that the Yellow Vests have done over the last couple of years in raising awareness about ways forward. I mean, they've done a fantastic job with their manifesto, saying, well, look, this needs to be fixed, bomb, 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 there you are. It's just off the shelf. It's almost an off-the-shelf programme for reform, the Yellow Vests in France. There
yes,
you go.
Yes, and they stood in the elections and got nowhere. Nobody voted for it.
Because
the media is under the control of the people it's under the control of. And also, of course, was not necessarily everybody is going to agree with you just because you've got an idea. That's not how it works,
well,
is
this,
it?
Well, this media isn't anyway, thank God. Let's sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Thanks also to our studio engineer, Dave Bazenko. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 6 with Danny Lopsch is always a good listen. Who knows, maybe we'll be back on there sometime. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday. Special wishes to Kevin Cahill, who I've been trying to phone, but he couldn't answer the phone because he's gone deaf and he's been trying for weeks to get a hospital appointment without success. So please put in a few words for Kevin with our maker to see if the hospital can actually help him sort out his deafness he's got at the moment. God bless. And don't let the Baxters get you down.
She was banished to the moon because she stole the pill of immortality from her husband. You might also look for her companion, a large Chinese rabbit, who is easy to spot since he is always standing on his hind feet in the shade of a cinnamon tree. The name of the rabbit is not reported.